From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, colleges and universities used to preach no means no as a way to reduce sexual assault, but that's beginning to change.
Now, colleges want kids to think of it in a slightly different way. They want them to ask, do you want to have sex? That is the way that they want, you know, an encounter to proceed.
Later, Tesla hopes to build 500,000 cars a year in the near future. Our automotive contributor wonders about the logistical and the manufacturing challenges that would ensue.
They didn't have as many of these issues because they weren't cranking out the cars in the numbers that require the line to be speeded up and the people to do things faster or maybe to be cross-trained to be able to do two or three different things.
And we talk with Michael Pink and resident choreographer Tim O'Donnell about the upcoming Milwaukee ballet season. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We're about halfway through the first semester of the academic year, and for freshmen, it's been often their first real taste of freedom in their lives, a time when they've become adults and have broken free of limitations they've had growing up at home.
It's a time of experimentation for many: alcohol, street drugs, and sex. And for the college and university environments, the sexual landscape in the 21st century is a complex one, with the hookup culture coexisting with greater awareness of sexual assault and the importance of consent.
Writer Vanessa Gregoriadis tries to navigate these shifting waters in a new book called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. We should note this is obviously a topic that might not be right for younger listeners. Vanessa Gregoriadis, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can we address something head on at the start? There was a little hesitation I had in taking on this interview, primarily because I am, you know, a man, and men are generally seen on a particular side of this kind of fraught environment. What did you see as the place of men in this conversation as you started digging into it?
I think it's rapidly changing, actually, the place of men in the conversation about sexual assault, particularly on campus, because there are so many guys, straight guys, guys who like to date girls, who are opening up to the reality that, you know, girls in college have a really different sexual playing field than guys do. And only by having guys as allies are we going to be able to fix the problem. You know, it's like a two-person dance. Got to do it together.
Well, and you know, this is both a very easy book to read for, you know, your compelling writing style, but a really tough book to read for the picture it paints of the politics of sex on college campuses. It has been a while since you were a college student, and I was a college student, to be honest. What were the biggest surprises you found when you went back, both to your alma mater, but more broadly to college campuses in general?
Yes, I went back to college campuses. I was there about 20 years after I graduated. So I figured, you know, as a mother of two, who better to explore sex on campus today other than me? And, you know, I think that the hookup culture, right, which all of us know that phrase, and sociologists think that started in the 90s. So when I was in school in Connecticut, that was beginning to be the way that college students interacted romantically. You know, hookup meaning, you know, kind of no strings. Oh, we'll just see if we both go to this party and we end up chatting, then maybe we'll go home with each other. But I don't really need anything from you and you don't need anything from me, right? And that is now really the norm on college campuses in terms of the beginning of dating. Of course, dating still happens. Of course, people still have long-term boyfriends and girlfriends. But at the beginning, there's very little of like, hey, can I bring you flowers and take you out to a movie tonight? You know, it's more like the Netflix and chill, right? That's, you know, that's a shorthand for what's going on.
Right. It seems like the whole nature of friendships has kind of changed. I mean, even people who aren't necessarily thinking of dating or were even thinking of hooking up, there seems like this sexually charged nature to friendships that a generation ago there might not have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's friends with benefits, you know, and part of friendship involves like, well, are we going to ever hook up? I mean, are we going to hook up or not? Like, because, you know, there's the friendship zone and then there's the hooking up zone and which side are you on and how do I categorize this person? But there's also like a lot of blurriness there of like, oh, okay, well, now we hooked up, well, we can be friends after. You know, I think it's just, it's all really very vague. And that was something that I found really striking because when you look at millennials, they're super planners, right? They want to get into a good school. They want to do well at that school. They're, you know, focused on like maybe not moving out of their mom or dad's house and getting a great job, but focused on their social media pages and how they can make them cool too. You know, and I spent a lot of time at Syracuse in the sororities, and you see these girls who really are, you know, top of the class, perfectly dressed, the sweatshirt with the Greek letters has no stains, like everything is the Google calendar and I've got 12 extracurriculars. And then, you know, their sex lives are totally vague. And well, I don't know, I'm going to kind of do whatever the guy wants and maybe I'll hook up and maybe I won't. And, you know, maybe I'll go all the way if he wants to. I said I wouldn't, but then I showed up that night and he wanted to, so I did. So there's a lot of kind of unresolved feelings, I think, around sex, particularly in this generation in college.
Well, and they're organized and they're driven in a lot of ways, but they are still, you know, 18 to 21 year olds.
Right. Right.
I mean, these are not fully formed people yet.
Yeah, they're post adolescents and they, you know, they don't have like a totally, I mean, they're academically, they're able to perform like adults, but emotionally they're still in a different place.
You know, so there are some people, and I gather you are one of them, that say there needs to be a way to add some nuance to the equation, that it doesn't necessarily make sense to put confused hookups in the same category as, you know, serial predators and gang rapes. And are there college campuses, as you got into it, that you saw having any success in addressing the gray areas?
Yeah, I do think a lot of college campuses that have adopted this yes means yes standard, which to a lot of adults sounds ridiculous, right? We all grew up with, if the woman does not say no, then no rape occurred, right? It is the woman's responsibility to say, I don't want to do this, push the guy away, something, you know, really dramatic has to happen there. Or a no, a shouted no, right? And now colleges want kids to think of it in a slightly different way. They want them to ask, do you want to have sex? That is the way that they want an encounter to proceed, so that the onus is not really on the girls to say no.
Well, and you talked with a number of college-age men or boys who have been accused of sexual assault. How did you view their stories when it came to, you know, these questions of things like affirmative consent, as they call it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is that the college-age boys who are accused of assault, that, you know, largely are who then take their stories to the media, right, are largely accused of these gray zones encounters. You know, you don't get a lot of physically violent rapists coming to the media and saying, I didn't do it. But those encounters, you know, it becomes really tough, because as much as a lot of feminists would like to say, you can't reduce this to a he said, she said, well, but you actually, like, if you're looking at it like a police detective, it looks a lot like a he said, she said to the police detective, right? There's very little physical evidence. You know, usually not injuries, maybe even a string of text messages before the encounter that involve flirtation, maybe on social media, maybe on Snapchat. And so it's really tough, because you do feel for these boys. At the same time, you don't know for sure if they've done it or haven't. Really in a mystery zone there, I think, in a lot of cases.
Right. I mean, I think you quote, you know, Niels Bohr's principle of great truths, you know, that there are situations that exist in which both the accuser and the accused, like, feel honestly like they're telling the truth here.
Well, I think that, you know, people who study this problem really think like we are caught in a moment of vast transition, not only in the way women are perceived professionally or socially in terms of women being breadwinners or taking on roles outside the home. You know, on college campuses, more girls are graduating than boys, right? But we're also in this vast transition in terms of the way that sexual dynamics are, you know, happening in the bedroom. And there are boys who are kind of caught in this time of transition, and we need to be fair to them, right? We need to say, well, you know, there are some cases where the boy will say, I truly didn't assault her, and the girl will truly feel assaulted, and they could both actually be right.
What might seem like sexual exploration to some might, you know, seem like sexual assault to others.
There is a fine line. At the same time, you know, there are a lot of guys who are stepping over the line.
Sure.
Like particularly girls who are really drunk to the point of not being able to speak English. You know, if you are flirting with that girl at a party and then taking her home, like I think college students are now pretty much coming into alignment that that doesn't make you cool. Like, you just took a girl with beer goggles home. Like, great. That was really easy, huh? You took advantage of her, you know? Whether or not she's going to go to the police and try to get you locked up for it, or go to her campus administrator and try to get you kicked out of school, and where between, you know, being very drunk and aware of what she's doing and being to the point of incapacitation, which is like, you know, blacked out, maybe certainly passed out, right? I don't know. Those are hard questions to answer. But what we do know is that the social norm around taking that girl home, you know, has really changed in terms of college guys not like high-fiving the guy the next day and saying, wow, that was awesome. You nailed that girl. Like that's not cool anymore. I think that's a big deal. And I think that, you know, kids should be commended for thinking through a lot of these problems on their own, you know, because they're not just listening to what the college deans are telling them, right? You know, they're really thinking about it. So, you know, changes, good changes are happening, you know, and I think we need to give them a little, you know, bit of applause for that.
Do you think colleges can address the issue of sexual politics like this without also getting into the issue of alcohol and casual drug use?
No, I don't. I really don't. Because I think a lot of the assaults that are happening, and they're always happening this time of year, September, late August, early September, between, you know, two people who don't know each other very well, who just arrived on campus. It's something like 88% of all gang rape victims on college campuses are freshmen. And like over three quarters of them are drunk. And either the guys will try to give alcohol to the girl and get the girl drunk because, you know, that's thought of as an easier way to get laid, or he'll really be a predator and really like trying to get the girl drunk. So, you know, really targeting her, which is horrible. Or the girl will be really drunk to the point where she may kind of wander into some guy's room at 4 a.m. who lives two floors down from her, who she just thought was cute. And maybe she just wants to go and like giggle and, you know, make some jokes. And, you know, from his point of view, you just came into my room at 4 a.m. Like, I think I know what you want, you know? And so he may push boundaries that she doesn't want to have pushed. So a lot of this weird stuff going on at the beginning of school, and a lot of it is connected to alcohol and drug use among, you know, kids who maybe haven't used that stuff that much at home, right? And they don't know when to stop drinking, right? Like, they don't know, like, 20 rum and cokes, not a good idea. Hold on, you know? So...
Well, and so would you make the point that as colleges are bringing kids in for orientation and they're talking about things like affirmative consent, they ought to also be talking about things like alcohol and drug use?
Yeah, I think they are talking about all of that, but they're talking about it separately. I think they have to discuss, like, consent is golden, and don't drink your consent away. Don't you know, after 9 drinks, a woman has a much higher probability of being assaulted. Now, 9 drinks for a woman, for an 18-year-old girl, that's a lot of drinks, you know? So I think that is a really important part of talking about, okay, go out, have a couple drinks. You know, this is college. Your mommy and daddy aren't looking over your shoulder, right? You're a big girl now. We all know that. But, you know, don't go somewhere with a bunch of people you don't know and continue to drink through the whole night. When you feel yourself getting out of control, go home. You know, I think that's really important.
Well, Vanessa Gregoriadis, it's easy to see why this is such a charged issue, but thanks for leading us through it somewhat.
Thank you.
Vanessa Gregoriadis' book is called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. We reached her in New York.
A short break now, and then we'll talk about the ambitious plans of the nation's cutting-edge electric car manufacturer. Our automotive contributors are coming your way in just a few minutes on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler wishes politicians would read more Shakespeare, especially the line in Richard III that goes, "When words are scarce, they are seldom wasted."
Spangler himself tries to take that lesson to heart in covering 3 separate topics in the span of 1 essay, starting with the demise of the family reunion.
Does your family have family reunions? Last summer, for the first time since 1935, there was no family reunion of our clan. As a boy, I remember 40 or 50 or more of our folks getting together, usually on somebody's farm, on one side of the Mississippi River or the other. So what killed our family reunion? Geography, mostly. Back then, people stayed put and didn't chase the economic crops across the country, with only a few exceptions. Dad's sister married a guy from California and moved to Pasadena. Aunt Pat moved to Las Vegas, but in her case, she was forgiven. You see, her husband was gassed in World War I, and the Iowa winters increasingly caused trouble with his gas-scarred lungs. That forced a move to the desert. Certainly, the weakening of the extended family is not news. Since so many of us live somewhere other than where we were raised, we have a hard time reinforcing those extended family ties. Baptisms, weddings, graduations, and wedding anniversary celebrations are hard to make when it's 500 miles each way on a weekend. As a result, many of we corporate nomads, and our numbers increase with each generation, don't really know our extended family members very well, and we have little in common with them or they with us. We are as strangers to each other. How do you keep a family reunion going with a bunch of strangers? Sad but true, fading family reunions are another unintended consequence of economic change. Now, having dissected the demise of family reunions, let's turn to the tattooed generation. Summer shows a lot more skin, and last summer's skin showed a lot more tattoos. But not for me. Even in the Marines, I was always a couple of beers shy of thinking a tattoo was a good idea. For those people who have tattoos, and we're talking about those whole arm or leg tattoos, the little butterflies are probably okay. I hope they really like the way they look, because they will be looking at them when they're 70. And having passed that age milestone a few years ago, I have seen many trends and fads come and go. Mostly reversible, thankfully. Blue hair, well, you can color it or just let it grow. Long hair of the 70s, gone, and then short hair. And now, long hair again, at least on football players. Wide lapels or narrow, same for neckties. Business casual or blue suits, white shirts, and red ties. All that keeps the suit stores in business. But one thing is certain about any fad or trend. It's only temporary. and that means the tattoo fad will end. And when the trend fades, the tattoo won't. A generation or less from now, when the next non-tattoo fad is well underway, will the folks then look at the inked-up people of today and say, what in the world were they thinking? And now that I've irritated the liberally tattooed among us, let me turn to the electrification of the auto industry. I saw yet another Chevy Volt, the all-electric General Motors car, the other day. They are becoming more common, along with Tesla for the high rollers among us. Carol and I could go to an all-electric car, I guess. The federal government still has a nice rebate for buying one. Imagine money flowing from Washington to our house for a change. The range between charges is getting longer, and if this fellow Musk has his way, soon the miles between charges will be the same as the miles between Phillips. So we could drive the electric car for errands around town during the day, congratulating ourselves about the gas we weren't burning or the pollution we weren't causing. We'd plug the car in at night so we'd all be recharged in the morning, us and the electric car. But where's all this electricity coming from? Do we have the electrical generating capacity for a million Wisconsin cars in addition to all of our other electrical needs? I don't know. But what I do know, or what I should say, is what the U.S. Energy Information Administration knows, is that in 2016, 52% of Wisconsin's electricity was generated by, are you ready? Coal. Dirty old coal. So as my wife and I would kilowatt around in our electric car, every other mile would be powered by coal. A 21st century version of the 1900 Stanley Steamer, a steam boiler-powered car fueled by you-know-what.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who now lives in Brookfield.
Jim Spangler may have his reservations about the wisdom of electric car manufacturing, but car makers are plowing forward. Chevrolet announced earlier this month that the company is moving towards an all-electric future. That word comes as Tesla continues to scale up production of a growing line of cars.
But how smooth is the road ahead for the company headed by Elon Musk? Lake Effect Automotive contributors Dan Harmon and Mark Savage talked this month about Tesla's plan to produce 500,000 cars a year in the future, and whether it is technology or just plain old manufacturing logistics that could get in the way.
You know, anybody who's an idea person and an inventor and so forth like he is and wanting to use all this new technology, I think it's easy to get wrapped up in kind of that techie end of things, which is all computers and kind of internal, you know, things you're doing in your head and doing on your screen, and you got, you know, 5 or 10 people working on a project and turning it into something really fabulous. And they've done a great job of all that. But now that they've hit a certain level and they want to build more than just one model of car and make 50 of them a year, you know, they're getting into that bigger manufacturing. I mean, they bought the NUMMI plant out in Fremont, California, that used to be a Toyota and GM plant. And they've got to make it work and build more than, you know, 10 cars a day. You've got to be cranking out 500 cars or whatever the maximum is out there to get to that 500,000 in the course of a year or two. Yeah, so that's old world technology, other than the fact that you've got the robots that are helping you put the cars together along with the people who are watching the machines and making sure that it is done just right.
And what I find interesting about all this is that the image of Tesla is very high tech. You know, it's a long-range electric car, certainly a technological achievement. But at the same time, it's a old school, in a way, manufacturing. I mean, you have to have a plant, you have to have equipment, you have to have labor. So in some ways, is it still high tech, or is this now a more typical manufacturing, automotive manufacturing facility?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the manufacturing, it is much more typical, and, you know, he's trying to join the big boys and make more of them, so he's not a specialty car maker anymore. So, yeah, now it comes down to it's kind of the unions or the pact that the unions want to help, you know, unionize the plant, the workers. What do they think? Are they buying into the, you know, whatever the mindset is of and the image of Tesla? Or I know that one of the things they've said, that they're going to offer stock options in the company as opposed to higher wages. Well, for some of us, we need the money up front. For some of us, we're willing to work at this for 5 or 10 years and then hope that we get rewarded down the way. And I think, like any private company, or now they're public, but even so, any private company mindset is, you know, you keep things secret, you do things on your own, and you don't want to lose your technology. And I think that may be what hurts you most with employees, because they want to know what's going on in that plant, and they want to know that things are safe, and they want to know that if something isn't working right, that it's being addressed, not just that, you know, down the road somewhere it's going to get fixed.
And as they grow with this pretty ambitious goal, which I believe 500,000 cars a year, not that long away, just a couple of years away, that's the goal anyway, some very old school issues are arising, things that we don't really hear about much anymore in automotive manufacturing, things such as, you know, having to work these incredible number of hours, or workplace injuries, which you don't really hear that much about in more mainstream automotive manufacturing anymore, just because the labor and regulations have kind of reached this sort of equilibrium between what are too many hours and what is too unsafe. So in some ways, because it's so new, that these issues are now coming back, issues that really haven't seen in decades.
Right. And I think you hit on it, that it is because this is a new operation, in that, like say, that they're ramping things up to make more cars. So they haven't had to face this in the past because they didn't have as many workers, and they didn't have as many of these issues because they weren't cranking out the cars and the numbers that require the line to be speeded up and the people to do things faster, or maybe to be cross-trained to be able to do two or three different things. So, yeah, it's going to be a learning process for them. And like anybody starting a new business, they've got to learn to deal with that. And whether the plant becomes unionized or whether they just start, you know, working to solve some of these problems on their own, I think that's the measure of how progressive they're going to be. Because the reason that many unions came up in companies, especially manufacturing companies over the years, because the management of the companies was not responding to the workers, or either wasn't protecting them, wasn't paying them enough, or wasn't giving them the right working conditions. So I think that things will change. It's just a matter of whether it's a forced change or whether Tesla on its own comes to the realization that maybe some of these things need to be dealt with quicker, and maybe set up some sort of a program within the company to have the employees have more input to make it either, whether it's safer or just, you know, limiting the number of hours a person can work so that they don't do something that ends up getting somebody hurt or damages the product. And now you start sending out, you know, crummy vehicles. That's the other thing they have to watch, is they got to keep their quality really high. They're charging premium prices right now for all of their products. And, you know, if they get the newer, smaller model out, maybe that will start to change some. But if I'm paying $75,000 to $100,000 for a car, I pretty much expect it to be perfect when I get it. And they've had some, you know, safety issues that obviously are high-tech related too, like the autopilot not working and the one fatality they had with that.
Do you think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that, are we watching as kind of a microcosm of automotive manufacturing history? Because I just can't help think that around the time that the Model T became the car for the masses and production was ramped up, like these same issues were happening, you know, more than a century ago, or right around a century ago. So do you think that this is a good kind of little microcosm of history of what, you know, it might have felt like way back when automotive manufacturing was just taking off?
Well, absolutely. And you think to yourself, in our lifetimes, there aren't a lot of car companies that got started up and are out still creating cars. I mean, you know, what do we have? Tucker, and we have DeLorean, and a few people like that, that they made a few of something, and then that was that, because either the cars didn't sell, or they didn't get the financing, or they couldn't keep the plants open because they didn't have the cash flow. So Tesla's dealing with all of that. You know, they're not unlike, I think, the Silicon Valley type companies, the computer companies and cell phones and so forth. And the Silicon Valley type companies, the computer companies and cell phones and so forth, and they've got to make the product and make it right. And of course, many of them have shipped a lot of that offshore. I'll give Tesla the credit of at least currently trying to work within the U.S. borders to get this thing made. And I believe they've got around 10,000 workers now out in California. That's a pretty good size plant to get coordinated and not only make the product but make it safe for the workers and make it so that they're happy workers, comfortable workers, you know, not working 90 hours a week or whatever. So it will be interesting to watch. And like I say, it is kind of a throwback to earlier times, but with a lot more maybe on the line at this point and a reputation of the whole company there.
So I guess there's all these issues tied together, of course. You mentioned there are accidents and a fatality. So as they grow rapidly, are they going to be able to keep up? Is quality going to slip? Are there going to be more safety issues, both with customers and with manufacturing? I guess I'm asking for a prediction, but do you have a feeling on that yet?
Well, why not? I think it's just a natural thing that the more they do, the more cars they produce, there's going to be some errors or problems. And some of it is that some of this is brand new technology that they've been working on. And so it depends on how much testing they're doing of their own product before it gets out the door. But yeah, there have been a few problems. The autopilot, obviously, and I think everyone's, you know, moving towards all this autonomous vehicle stuff, which we've talked about in the past. You know, this is new stuff, and there's going to be some problems. You would like to hope that it doesn't lead to fatalities and that no one putting it together gets hurt seriously putting it together, because I think that's a lower risk, generally speaking. But they've had the autopilot. They've had electric park brake that has been a problem, at least to some degree. And I know the Institute of Highway Safety did not give them their highest rating recently. They did a couple others like the Prius and the Volt, but the Tesla fell a little short because the driver's seatbelt didn't restrain the driver quite enough, and they could actually hit their head on the steering wheel. Well, you know, these are things that are going to happen because you're making more and more, and they're getting out there, and the cars are into more situations that they haven't been in the past. So people are going to, you know, there's no testing like real-world testing, and unfortunately, if you're the person who bought it, that, you know, you're kind of the guinea pig in your own way. And so, yeah, some of these things are going to sneak through, and something's not going to work right. So let's hope that nothing's too horrible and that they correct it and that they can keep rolling. And, I mean, I think it's a great thing because I think they're pressing the auto industry forward in their own way. Some of us are not as wild about autonomous cars as others, but it's certainly interesting. And if that's the way we're going to go, that's the way we're going to go. And they're taking the lead on it.
I find it interesting that you use the phrase guinea pig, where when things are going well, you're considered an early adopter. And if there's an accident, you're a guinea pig.
Yeah, well, there's a fine line between early adopter and guinea pig, I think.
So at this point, do you consider Tesla to be more of a manufacturing company, or are they still a tech company? Or do you want to combine them into a high-tech manufacturing company?
Yeah, I think they're more the high-tech manufacturing company. Like I say, their product has a lot of high-tech features to it, as all the cars do now, actually. But, you know, that they have a very high-tech product that they're trying to get out the door, and they're trying to manufacture it in great numbers. So they're working their way towards becoming a major manufacturing company also. And, you know, who knows what will come from that. Maybe they'll have some other products that spin off of that and won't just be cars that they're doing, but other things that either they're selling us to add onto our cars or that there's something totally different.
Yeah, well, they already do sell technology to current manufacturers like Volvo.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. You know, why it's kind of the don't keep reinventing the wheel. If somebody's already figured it out, let's, you know, buy that technology from them and put it into your vehicles. And I know we've talked about this with the autonomous cars in the past. That's why I'm saying and predicting still eventually there'll be 2, 3, 4 car brands, because branding won't matter too much because we'll all have the same technology in our cars, which you're seeing. You know, some of the $15,000 to $25,000 cars now have some of the same high-tech stuff that the luxury makes had 5 years ago. So it's working its way down to the rest of us.
And as a final question, this number Elon Musk has for production, which is 500,000 cars, I believe, annually, that is a lot of that is the new car, the car for the masses, if you will, the smaller one. What are your predictions on that car? Is it a make-or-break proposition for them?
Well, I think most small cars for most of the manufacturers are mainly people to get people into your brand. They're kind of the loss leaders. They get them into your brand, and then they want to buy the next model up. So my guess is that they're not looking to those entry-level cars for huge amounts of profits. I mean, obviously, you'd like to break even or make a little profit on it. But I think that they're looking to help build the brand and say it's not just this Model S that's $100,000 out here. You can get in at this level and then 5 years later maybe move up to the next level. And, you know, pretty soon, you know, when you're 45, 50 and you're a CEO somewhere, you can buy that S model. But so I think, you know, I think they'll do all right. I think they have been successful so far. And I have no reason to believe that they won't be successful in rolling this out. I think their main challenge that they have to watch is how they do business so that they keep making a profit and or make a profit, maybe not keep making one, but make a profit, and they have the finances to keep them going forward until they've reached that sustainability part of the business.
Okay, Mark. Well, there's certainly an interesting company to watch.
It's a lot of fun to watch. I wish there were three or four more car makers, new car makers out there. That'd be fun.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column Savage on Wheels for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He's also the executive editor of American Snowmobiler Magazine and the editor of Fine Scale Modeler Magazine. They're both part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars.
One last break and then a preview of the upcoming season for the Milwaukee Ballet, including this weekend's season opening production of La Boheme. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
We're back on Milwaukee Public Radio. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This weekend, the Milwaukee Ballet opens its season with a production of artistic director Michael Pink's adaptation of Puccini's La Boheme.
Ahead of those performances, we invited Pink, along with dancer and resident choreographer Tim O'Donnell, into the studio to look ahead at the season. Pink starts with an update on the company itself.
The company is going extremely well. We've had another wonderful financial year. We ended with a balanced budget. We have, as you know, we're looking forward to investigating more the potential of a new home. We've purchased land in the Third Ward. Very exciting. And we have, as always, at the beginning of every season, we have an intake of new dancers, not just in our second company, which is the Milwaukee Ballet Troupe, but also in the main company. And that's always very exciting because it's the beginning of a new relationship. And it's interesting for me to see how those new dancers come in, how they integrate themselves within the company, and then the journey of getting to know them. And a production like La Boheme, which is fundamentally a production built on principal characters, is an interesting one for me. If some of those new dancers are cast in those roles, you get an opportunity to really work closely with them. As always, the school continues to grow, and we have new people coming in, new choreography happening, so many wonderful things happening, as indeed is happening in the city as well. The growth that we're seeing around us, where you are here in the studio, just to look around and see all the cranes in the sky. It's a very exciting time, and it feels about right because I've been here 16 years, and I couldn't wait much longer, you know.
For things to change.
Yeah, well, things to grow, things to move, yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things that's really happening, it seems to be, this has always been something that you and Mark Clements and Bill Forescu have done, but now seem to be doing more, a lot of collaboration between the companies and finding ways to bring dancers into productions, the opera that just happened with The Merry Widow, and other things like that. Do you see that growing?
I do, and I think there's a real appetite for that level of growth. It's complicated in terms of just managing people's time and availability and resources, but it's very rewarding when you can achieve it. And indeed, we're very optimistic that where there is a will, there is a way to make these things work. And they are, of course, they're a benefit and asset for the community. And they help, I think, bring people closer to the realization that there are an awful lot of extremely talented artists and organizations in this city. Because I still meet people who have no idea there's a ballet company in town or an opera company. So whilst that remains, then the more we need to promote ourselves, work together, and encourage the audience to really feel confident about going to the theatre and then develop some healthy opinions about things. Because I love hearing what people have to say, even though sometimes it's not particularly encouraging, shall we say. It's still good to hear people have a point of view about things. Would that everybody would really air their points of view more about things, and then we can, you know, we can all grow from that.
Exactly. And I was also thinking that with this kind of collaboration, you get the chance of cross-pollination with audiences. Maybe somebody who would never have gone to the ballet before sees something in another kind of concert that they do go to, and they say, wait a minute.
That would absolutely be the hope that people really would. And that's about confidence, just getting the confidence to step over the threshold into the theater, not really expecting too much other than to sit down and let it happen in front of you, and then have a point of view about that. And I think that's part of, I know Tim and all of the younger dancers in the company feel very strongly about when they're out in the community talking up the ballet, talking up other events, so that people also understand that ballet is a young person's art form, and these are very young, dedicated, focused people, and they want to feel that their contemporaries and the people that they're socializing with will come and support them and see them. Because if we can get people at that age level involved, then I think that will benefit all of the arts community. Because hopefully they'll stay and they'll be curious and right. want to find out more.
And they create a lifelong relationship
with it.
Yeah. And Tim, so bringing you in on this, you're one of the resident, not only a dancer, but a resident choreographer now too,
That's
right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, so how does that feel stepping in? I mean, you've been doing choreography all along, and we've talked many times about different things that you've said on the dancers, but, you know, how does it feel to be one of the people doing that all the time now?
It's fantastic being the resident choreographer. I think it's a great honor, and it's something a lot of young choreographers strive for. I do feel a little bit like it makes me question myself more than I used to, because I think when I was just a choreographer, I think anyone was impressed that I'd done anything. But now, whether or not it's true, I probably put a lot more expectation on myself to create something good and valuable for the company or wherever else I happen to be working. But in this company, we've got so many young choreographers. This is really exciting. We've got a season coming up later in the year where five of us will be creating new work for the company. So I'm not the only young choreographer here.
Right. The pressure isn't just on you. But does having that structure behind you allow you more freedom as a choreographer as opposed to going in like one time and doing something?
I think it makes it a lot easier when working with the dancers because I'm so familiar with the way they move and the way they perform and the way they're going to interpret my own movement. Like I know if I do a step like this, I hate the step on my body, but I know I'm going to love it on his body or on her body. So that makes it easier. But sometimes there's something exciting about working with people you don't know as well, which is what we're experiencing now with new dancers coming in that Michael was talking about before. They take things to new places.
Right. I was going to say that it just changes the dynamic all the way around. It's that whole new blood infusion idea. You
Absolutely.
Know,
it's like getting a new set of paints sometimes.
Right.
New colors.
You see different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I imagine that's amazingly exciting.
Yeah.
And so you're still dancing, though, too. So you're wearing a couple of hats.
Yes, a few. I also do some work with the marketing team as well.
Do you pay him for all of these things, Michael?
We do. We give him a one-time payment, and then we make him do everything.
Okay.
It's a wonderful relationship.
Yeah.
But actually, what Tim was just saying, his work with the marketing department, I think for a year prior to Tim coming back, because people will remember he was a winner of the Genesis choreographic competition, I think he took a year out, and he was doing graphic design and working in marketing ideas, which is, for me, that's so exciting because nobody can really speak better about an art form than an artist themselves and somebody who is living through it, experiencing somebody like Tim who has so many interests and so many avenues to be able to explore that it's just so exciting. I love the idea of regenerating our dancers as much as possible back into the organization. If I could have a company of dancers and then a management that is just filled with talented dancers who have other skills, I think that would be so... Well, I know. I don't even think.
I was going to say, you kind of have that already.
We do. Yeah. And it's something we've really been building on and down to the teaching faculty. So it's a great opportunity here in Milwaukee again. And I think that's because of there's a good working environment. It's a slow-paced place, as we know. People take things slowly. They think about them. And then when they move forward and they make a commitment, they really do make a commitment. And we're finding that so many of the dancers are happy to call Milwaukee home whilst being a professional artist and then in life beyond that, which I think is something that the city can feel very proud about as much as we do.
So talk about Bohème. That is the first one of this season, and it's coming up very quickly.
La Bohème, indeed, yes. We premiered this in 2012. Tim originated the role of Marcello, who is the second of the two male leads in the production, Rodolfo and Marcello. It's very exciting for it to come back. I mean, for opera lovers, it is the Bohème that you know and love without the singing. But I will say that as we found out in 12, and I think we're going to find out again here in 17, is that it's a new experience. Without the wonderful, glorious voices, it's still an incredible experience to listen to Puccini and almost pay more attention to the music than you do when the singer is on stage. It's a very, very powerful, emotional experience. And what the ballet can bring to the story and to the music is this youthful agility, this physicality that just doesn't happen in operas because of the nature of the art form. And as I look at it, I said last night to Luth San Miguel, who is once again coming back as Mimi and is now transitioning into my ballet mistress, that I need to go back and look at the opera again now, because I've now become so immersed in the ballet version that I need to just take a step back just to remind myself of what potentially are the strengths and weaknesses of doing it as a ballet. It's also very, very exciting and very rare that I get a chance to really be a director. And when I say a director, I mean a theater director. We have had the luxury of time to be able to explore the what-ifs. What if you do this? And this doesn't quite make sense. So how do we maneuver around? And it's the minutiae. If I just stand on this side and I'm here, it's stronger. Little things that we never have time to do. So I am so excited about that. I'm treating and spoiling myself, because once we get to Beauty and the Beast, which is another world premiere, that isn't going to happen.
No, you're going to be sort of on the rocket ship.
We're going to be churning it out 100 miles an hour. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, Bohème lends itself. There's something about both the story and the score that lends itself to lots of interesting treatments. I mean, Tim, one of your countrymen, Baz Luhrmann, did an amazing production of it.
Yeah, with the Australian Opera, yeah.
With the Australian Opera, mm-hmm. that was both sung but had wonderful movement in mm-hmm. it, and it was kind of that mix. And there's something about it, even if when you know what happens, you want to see what happens.
Well, I mean, you know, Rent was just at the PAC.
Yeah.
That's a modern adaptation of La Bohème. Yeah, I think it was really the Baz Luhrmann. I saw a video of the...
That's what I did too. Unfortunately, I wasn't there. Yeah.
And that confirmed my thoughts about how well this would translate. Because, yes, it's very cinematic. His wife did an extraordinary job in designing the space, as always. And then, of course, he went to Broadway for... and had three casts for the principal roles, and they did 8 shows a week, and it really brought it closer to a new generation of people, and so I'm hoping that the ballet will do that again. It will re-engage people, it will introduce people, and people will be rushing to see the opera, and also rushing to find other videos of it, because it's timeless. It's about bohemian artists, which we qualify on every single level.
Particularly the poverty part.
The poverty part, indeed, and having to live. We know where some of them live. And the conditions.
In the garrets.
In the garrets, yes. Yeah. So it lends itself in every level. And again, the intimacy that can be created. And when I think about our PAC stage, which I try not to do too often because it's so large and overbearing half the time, to be able to have an intimate scene where just the delicate touch of a hand on the face can be read from the back of the house and have emotional impact is just very exciting. And it's a testament to all the years of work that we've done here and the company of dancers that we've had.
Do you have more performances this time where everyone gets a chance?
No, we still, sadly, we only have the 4 performances, so 2 each. We won't talk about that. But we will look to the future, because just maybe if we have a little bit more time in the hall, we can move to the much desired 2 weekends of these productions. That is part of my goal, because I do believe as our city grows that we should be able to perform for 2 weekends. Most other companies around the country of our scale are doing that already, and it works.
It was highly successful when we did Dorian Gray. It also gives us time as a company to do the weekend, to then go back to the studio to have a think about how some things work, and then take it back to the stage again. So I think for everyone it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, just artistically, it gives you a chance to work out some of the kinks and also, like you say, think about it and come back with that. Even though it's only a few days of a break, you have a chance to come back and say, ooh, let's try this.
And also for word of mouth, for our marketing department as well, it gives us a whole week for people who have firstly seen the production to get out in the community and say things, because we open here on a Thursday. And sometimes by Sunday, you know, those people haven't seen all their friends or it's too late for them to suddenly buy tickets. But being able to think a week in advance is fantastic.
Yeah. So, there are many, many benefits to doing that. And
right.
that's one of my my goals, is to make sure that that happens. Because it is soul destroying to spend 5 weeks in the studio working 6-7 hours a day to create something, to fine-tune, to explore, and then to get into the theater and everything's going on, the lights and the music and everything happens and you open and close in the same weekend, it's soul-destroying. There are times when I just think, really, is it worth it? Of course it is, because it's capturing a moment of what we do very well. But boy, that's the reason why Nutcracker, we love Nutcracker so much, even though we do it year upon year, is you get to go into the theater, unpack, and stay there for 3 weeks.
It must feel like forever.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, yeah. I've noticed some of the dancers bring the you know, the kettle and the TV and start to make it look like home, which is what you do if you're in a Broadway show or something and you're going to sit down for 2 years and do it. But that's a wonderful opportunity. And the most important thing is that you grow as an artist when you practice your art form in front of a live audience who give you feedback. The more you can do that, the more you can grow, which is back to where I come from, and certainly from the same with Australian Ballet, doing many, many more performances of any one show. In England, we would do probably 200 performances a year with 3 programs. Well, here we do 5 programs.
And 4 performances like, each. Yeah,
then apart from the Nutcracker. So the balance is slightly out of whack, really, if one is thinking about it. The opera and the ballet are very expensive art forms to produce, because we want to make sure that we have live music and we want to make sure we need a lot of costumes and we need the space. Well, if we could just play it for a longer spell, we'd have a chance to recoup some of those costs and grow as artists and as an organization.
Well, here's hoping.
I'm going to make it happen.
Make it happen.
I'm going to make
okay.
it happen.
Okay. Yeah. And we will talk about it when that happens. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for coming in. Best of luck. And I am looking forward to seeing Bohème again, because I saw it 5 years ago and I am so looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, theater still is a place you can escape to and leave the rest outside.
Sit down with some beauty. That can't be wrong.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
And if you did see it last time, it has evolved, definitely.
Oh, good.
For this run.
Okay.
Oh,
well, I would hope so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you expect. And you're 5 years older, yeah. And you're a different dancer.
Thanks for bringing
like
that up.
Like a fine wine, we have matured.
But you don't look it at all, Tim. You look fabulous.
You.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much.
Bonnie, thank you.
Michael Pink is artistic director, and Tim O'Donnell is leading artist and resident choreographer for the Milwaukee Ballet. Michael Pink's La Bohème opens Thursday evening and runs through the weekend at Eline Hall. There is more information at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.